Creator Chat is brought to you in part by Audible. Audible is, of course, the premier audiobook service, perfect for folks who want their books read to them. Thousands and thousands of titles to choose from in all genres, sci-fi, fantasy, biographies, history, thrillers, mysteries, and more. We've got a great offer for listeners on this podcast, 2 free audiobooks when you sign up. And those books are yours to keep even if you decide to cancel your Audible subscription, which is $14.95 a month and gives you a free book every month of your choosing, as well as some other fun perks. Membership has its privileges. Hit up bit.ly/geekbookclub to start your free trial and get those 2 free books on lock. Once again, bit.ly/geekbookclub. And now, let's get into the show. Welcome to another Creator Chat on the SGGQA podcast channel, an occasional series of interviews where we get to hear from folks making cool things on the internet. I've said it before on this show, and I'll probably say it again, but there's something so surreal about producing these interviews. Whenever I listen to podcasts, I have a running conversation playing out in my head with the podcast hosts. Those times I've been a guest on All About Android, there's always a moment when it hits me. I'm not just playing this out in my head. The hosts are actually replying to me. This is a real conversation, not an imaginary one. For a huge chunk of my gadget reviewing career, Jason Howell has been one of those voices I've followed in tech commentary. A down-to-earth style, some charm, some wit, and a thoughtful approach to consumer commentary. Few folks in any creative industry can claim the same consistency and quality in producing a show as Jason can. Closing in on 10 years of producing and hosting All About Android, I geeked out with this fantastic host to chat about how he got into the creator space and the changes he's seen in producing online content. We are live. Jason, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
What's happening? It's great to join you. Thanks for inviting me on.
Of course. You're kind of helping me come back from a brief hiatus of doing these creator chats. Took a little bit of a window, and then the world went a little bit crazy. So just to start off, I'd like to check in with my friends. You know, we don't get those same water cooler chats as often as we used to. How are you holding up? What's going on in your neck of the woods?
In light of everything that's happening right now, I think I'm holding up pretty good. I feel pretty fortunate right now that I can continue to work full time. You know, for Twit, you know, we're still churning out our podcasts and everything. As you can see, I've converted the corner of our master bedroom. Like, literally, found out that mm-hmm. we were going to have to do our podcast from the house, and I was like, okay, so we have a den that has all of my music equipment in it, and it has my music production studio and everything like that. The problem is the den has no door that separates it from the kitchen. So it's like den right next to the kitchen, which is right next to the living room. And, you know, of course, we have 2 kids, so they're home all day doing schoolwork, and my wife is working with them a lot of the time. So it was like, if I'm going to be podcasting, like, it can't be where the actual studio is. So I had to convert the corner of our master bedroom into a little podcast corner. It's that, like, in order for me to leave this spot, I literally have to climb under the table that's in front of me, because there's no way.
So, like, you just gotta play kind of like a game of human Jenga.
That's pretty much what it is. Yes. Every single time I'm like, oh God, I gotta get out of here now. And, you know, I climb under the table. So we're making do, which is about as much as you could expect anyone to be doing right now, right? This whole world is so crazy right now. I feel very fortunate and very grateful that I'm continuing to, you know, have a job in this climate and creating content for everyone. It's a nice distraction for me as well.
It's really exciting from our work perspective, because I mentioned this in a recent review. It's like, when times get weird, it's actually kind of an incredible opportunity for us to really put some of these claims to the test. You know, when everything's going right in the world and you're like, oh, I got a new phone, or I've got this new laptop, or I'm working on these accessories. Yeah, I think in my brain, like, it makes sense. This could work. And never before have we been, you know, linking up my wife's work laptop to external monitors and setting up a second workspace and trying to keep our daughter entertained with some school work, but then also not trying to, you know, burn her out too much. And we're having to be way more nimble and flexible. At the same time as we're going a little stir crazy, there's that one little sick visceral thrill for me where it's like, man, I'm really getting to test this stuff in a way that I never would have imagined.
Yeah, yeah, I completely agree. It's been interesting for me because usually a lot of the technology that we talk about on the Twit Network or that I talk about, you know, I have an office which is, you know, about 7 or 8 minutes away from where I live here in Petaluma. And in my office, I tend to keep a lot of the technology that ends up on the shows because I like to have it there because that's where the shows are recorded and everything. It also allows me at home to not over technology the house as far as that's concerned. You know, I can kind of have a little separation between church and state.
The work-life balance.
Yeah,
exactly.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And now, you know, everything happens out of the house. And so, like, I've got a stack of phones, probably got like 10 phones on the desk right now. I think we've got between my wife and I and the kids, you know, we've probably got like 5 laptops floating around for the different school work, you know. And I fully realized right off the top, total first world problem. It's amazing that I have access to this stuff because it's really made so many things so much easier and possible. Whereas I'm sure there are a lot of families, certain there are a lot of families that don't have that sort of access, and it's a lot more difficult, a lot more challenging. But I've come to appreciate my home as kind of a little bit of a sanctuary from like technology all the time. And now I'm not quite getting that, but at the same time, I'm really happy to find kind of a little bit of the equilibrium that we are finding. You know, our kids are definitely spending more time on screens and that sort of stuff because it's part of their curriculum now to do that. And, you know, they don't have friends that they can play with face to face. So they play with them on the screen, maybe playing a game or whatever. So we have to kind of like loosen our grip on it a little bit. And between the four of us, we're finding a new point of equilibrium that I think is healthy. It's a good, like a refreshing discovery for me to be like, oh, okay, we can figure this out. We can make it work.
Yeah. I always have to, I'm trying to be very careful in a lot of my commentary and on the podcast and stuff where, you know, I don't want to sort of bemoan, oh no, my wife is working from home and I used to just work all by myself at home and now we're kind of stepping on each other's toes. Because the flip side is exactly what you were mentioning. I'm in a very rarefied position. I'm in a very unique position where we've had the tools and the access. And it's the one thing I think I've noticed from some of my other friends. I feel, you know, like Jason, when you and I were growing up, there was that notion of the home computer was this like workspace for the grownups and you could go away from the rest of the house. But in an age of tablets, laptops, and smartphones, I don't think as many families have kind of carved away that nook or put away that space. And it makes this challenge that we're all facing now, the psychological aspect of that, a lot more challenging than I think a lot of people are expecting when this all started.
Yeah, it's true. It used to be there was a single computer in a home and it was put out in a common space so that the parents could watch over the children. Of course, that wasn't how it was in my family growing up.
Oh, really?
My first computer was a Commodore 64. And I had to convince my parents to let me buy one. This was in the 5th grade. And they allowed me to have it in my room, which was not a very smart thing for them to do. They just didn't know better.
Oh,
and I got into tons
man.
Of trouble because of it. But
young Juan is so jealous of that because I had to like fight for time on the family 8088, you know, like, you know, just pounding out like DOS prompts and trying to get to my favorite little Snipes or Ninja game. But dad actually has to Telnet into work because that's why we had the computer. The little part of me, a little kid part of me just got so jealous.
Yeah.
You were able to keep it in your room.
It's okay because it comes with its downside. I got into a lot of trouble when I was a kid between 5th and 7th grade. I totally diving right into it here, but I got way into the bulletin board systems and the BBSs that were around, and ultimately ended up falling into the, let's say, air quotes, wrong crowd, the freaking and hacking crowd. And the whole culmination of which resulted in an early morning visit by the Secret Service to our house when I was in seventh grade that prevented me from going to school, and you know, a bunch of people in my bedroom pilfering through everything to see how much I knew and what kind of codes I had and everything. It was a whole ordeal. So be okay with the fact that you didn't have a computer in your room, because you could have gone down a completely different path that you didn't want to go.
I don't know,
down.
Man. That's some hack the planet, you know. kind of shenanigans right there. I almost feel like maybe I missed out a little, you know. I never lived that dangerously.
Totally. Yeah, it was an interesting situation.
So that's actually where I like to kick off a lot of these conversations, and I think for a number of us who have been in this kind of tech commentary game for a while, it started out as a very early passion at the dawn of this kind of home computing boon. About how old were you, did you say, when you started playing with your Commodore? You said
I got that in the fifth grade. Yeah, it was early fifth grade. So how old are we when we were in the fifth grade? 11, 12, somewhere around there?
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Yeah. And I mean, but prior to that, I don't know that I had any real access to a computer outside of a friend's house that I would go, and his dad had a Sinclair that we would putz around on. And he may have also had a TRS-80, if I remember correctly. I remember going into Radio Shack and just sitting in Radio Shack for like hours during the summer break and playing their TRS-80 that was on the shelf, just because I knew I could go in there and play a free video game for however long and stuff. But that was the first computer that I owned, was probably 10 or 11.
God, such a golden age too. I mean, I like to see like a Micro Center or, you know, any other kind of brick and mortar pop up. But I miss those uber nerdy days of hanging out in a Radio Shack and getting bits and pieces and parts and knowing like, well, Dad said we needed to fix something on the main board, so I guess we're going to be breaking out the soldering iron tonight. And I mean, that's what we did on the computer.
This whole technological world, you know, involving computers and everything was. I mean, in many ways, it was a hobby versus a way of life. Now it's a way of life. Now it's just, it's so everywhere. Like you were saying, you know, the fact that each of my kids has a tablet, they basically each have a computer that they use on a daily basis. And that's just part of their language. You know, when we were kids, we had to find ways or reasons to like find that time, because it was a hobby and it was really misunderstood by most people. Most people didn't understand why.
Well, and you know, even from my own early experiences, I always kind of felt like it was going to stay as some sort of counterculture to mainstream life.
Yeah,
I never imagined. I mean, like if I'd been smarter in investing, you know, obviously I'd be a far richer man than I am today. But how many of us like also just kind of missed the boat that like I'd never really be at the cool kids table, because I'd always be, you know, kind of messing with, you know, circuits and boards and programming over here on the side. From those early experiences, I always feel like there's like an inciting incident, or like there's a moment that someone can kind of reflect on or think back on, where you decided you wanted to do more than just participate with this hobby, and that you were encouraged to start contributing to more of the community around this hobby. I'm wondering what that might have looked like for you, because now you make, you know, a good chunk of your living as a technology commentator, as a journalist in this space. Where did you start trying to engage, you know, out of the message boards and the forums and things like that? What did that look like for a younger Jason?
I mean, I don't know that I ever necessarily saw my going in this direction as a kid. I just really enjoyed technology and I understood it to a certain degree, but there was also a certain level of technology that was always kind of out of reach with me too. I would never have thrived as a programmer. I just didn't have the brain for
it. Did you try?
What's that?
I made it three semesters into CS and like hated my life and like I've got to get out. Yeah. I'm not cut out for this.
Absolutely. Same. I mean, when I graduated high school, you know, I grew up in Boise, Idaho. When I graduated high school, I went immediately into the next semester, like my first semester at Boise State University. And one of my courses was computer science because I like computers. So I'm going to love going to a computer science class. I don't even remember. Like, I must have flunked out of that class. Like, I did not do well because it just wasn't what my idea of what computer science would be. I just thought, like, I enjoy computers. This is a way for me to be closer to them. I didn't really think, oh, wait a minute, you actually have to be, like, really smart in a very particular way in order for this to make a lot of sense and for you to thrive in this.
Well, and also,
I did not find it fun.
It was, for me, it was the fortitude. I mean, like, I loved coding small challenges. I loved solving puzzles. I had one of the best solutions for the prisoner's dilemma contest that we had by accident. There were two versions of the prisoner's dilemma, and I spent so much time crafting this great algorithm that was going to try and defeat someone else. And then I had a little extra time left over, and professor said, you know, your grade is dependent on how you score, and you can submit as many as you want. And so I coded something that I thought was going to play to lose just as a gag. And that one ranked in like the top 10 for all of the students. And my beautifully coded algorithm was just destroyed in the first round of this whole contest. And so then I realized, like, I am not cut out for the marathon, which is computer coding. I'm good for a sprint. And yes. I think I should probably get out now.
Right. Yeah. It requires a whole lot of a lot of something that I just, a lot of patience and analytical thinking. I mean, I can be a pretty analytical thinker on certain things, but not in that way. So I realized ultimately, like, that wasn't, and I will say, like, in my early days, like Commodore 64 days, I actually did a lot of basic programming.
Yeah.
Like I got certain concepts of it. I would create games, word games, games with like ANSI, like ASCII art and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I would create that on the Commodore 64, and my goodness, what I would give to like have access to those floppies and be able to look at them now. They're long gone and lost. But so it's not like it was outside of my experience. It's just when I grew up and realized how complicated it can be, it just did not click for me. But there's always been a thread for me with just a true like love and desire for like good consumer technology. You know, just technology that's maybe a little bit easier to understand, that does cool things. Oh, wait a minute, now I can use that camera and be just like, you know, my idols in the film industry and do that crazy wipe. That's really cool that I can do that. Now, great. Those are the things that got me really excited. And the long answer to your question is I don't think I ever, for a very long time, had any sort of sense that I would end up doing what I'm doing much later.
Hey, podcast listeners. I work really hard to find mutually beneficial ways to support production on my various distribution platforms. Instead of just running ads on this podcast and hoping they don't annoy you, I want to find products or services that you really will get something out of and that can help fund my production. While I do talk about some of those items in ads throughout this podcast, I've never created one easy-to-view master list of my current partnerships until now. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. If you'd like to help contribute, support production of this podcast and my various videos and reviews, head on over to somegadgetguy.com. At the top, there's going to be a link for Support Some Gadget Guy, and you can see what my current partnerships are. At the time this podcast was recorded, in addition to my Patreon, we can hook you up with a $10 voucher for shopping a new OnePlus, save 20% on some One More headphones, sign you up for Google Fi service, Amazon affiliate links, Audible, or you can grab a Mega Pickle coffee mug of your very own. Savory, delicious Mega Pickles. Head on over to SomeGadgetGuy.com, support banner on the top right-hand side of my website, and hopefully you find something cool, something you like, while also kicking me a little extra scratch. But where do you think that transition happened? Because I feel there's always sort of an interesting like reflection point.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it was participating on Windows Mobile PDA forums and realizing, like, I'm writing articles. I'm trying to help people. And now this is as much a part of my passion for technology, is that form of communication, is that conversation, as just purely consuming the technology on its own. And where do you think you made that transition? Because I think, again, I feel like we're cut from some similar cloth in that regard. Those things tend to happen a little bit later for us. It's not like YouTube was a thing that we wanted to be influencers or, you know, podcast hosts from the very beginning of our technological career. It's something that we always kind of end run into. Where do you think that might have happened for you?
Well, I mean, I could point to ultimately, like in my late 20s, I went to San Francisco State and got an audio production degree. And my whole goal then was, oh, wait a minute, I can get a degree doing something that I love. I never realized I could do that before. And they have, you know, they have a really good program at San Francisco State. I'll do that. I'll get into the music recording industry. That'll be where I end up. That was my ultimate dream, was to be like a recording engineer in the studio with bands and stuff. When I graduated, you know, a lot of the internships and stuff that I was doing, like they were nice, they were unpaid, there was nothing like full time, had to pay the bills, working in the restaurant industry and everything. And ultimately, like, I worked in the restaurant industry for the majority of my time to put myself through university, and like, it was a great moneymaker, but I really just didn't want to work there anymore. I was like, I am not going to be a lifelong, you know, restaurant industry worker. God bless them. They're great for what they do, just not for me. So how can I get out of this? And I saw a post for a CNET job for kind of media production. And it was more heavily on the video side than audio side. But I was like, you know what? Video is going to be easy. I've already got the audio background. I'm sure there's a lot of crossover. And ultimately, they gave me the internship, and that turned into a full-time job. So I never explicitly said, I want to get into the business of telling stories around technology. It was really just finding a job that was technology enough, that was based on my degree enough, that I felt like I could finally stop working in the restaurant industry, know that my full-time gig was involved with what I went to school for, and, you know, I enjoy the process and all that. And it's just kind of my luck that when I, you know, worked at CNET for a couple of years, something opened up on the podcast side, on the consumer tech side. Prior to that, I was on the B2B side with ZDNet. On the consumer tech side, you know, they needed a producer for Buzz Out Loud, which was Tom Merritt, Molly Wood, and Veronica Belmont's show. Veronica was kind of transitioning, and they needed a producer to come on, and that's what I did. And so my job, my career path, you know, that I'm on right now, really just kind of came out of like, well, I could do that. Like, I've got an audio background. Podcasts were a new thing, but I knew enough to know, like, that's just really recorded audio. Like, awesome. Right. That gets me even closer to my dream of working with audio and sound. And so I did that.
And so where did you transition out of being going from like a producer segment, you know, recording engineer, that kind of work, into actually trying to host your own content?
Well, I mean, Buzz Out Loud, for those who aren't too familiar with it, it was a pretty popular daily technology podcast in the early days of podcasting, from like 2005 on, I believe. And then it was Tom Merritt, Molly Wood, and Veronica Belmont was the producer. But ultimately, they ended up pulling Veronica. You know, she was the producer, but they started like bringing her into the conversation.
Right.
And she became another one of the voices on the show. So the same thing kind of happened to me. You know, I was helping out on the show. Tom and Molly would kind of ask my opinion on things or encourage me to speak up. And I was super shy and embarrassed, but I did it anyways. And, you know, if I went back and listened to those recordings, it would be really hard for me to listen to myself, because sometimes I'm just talking, not because I had anything to say, but just because I felt like I needed to talk and I didn't know what to say. And, you know, and that's how the transition happened. Ultimately, that led into, oh, hey, what would you like to do this show? You know, gadgets, and, you know, you can talk about, you know, crazy goofiness. It was just a comedy show more than anything.
Right.
And, you know, for a long time, I was a producer that also talked on shows. It wasn't until I got to Twit, and years into my job at Twit, and probably I would say the official switch over to where it was, I am no longer editing video. I am no longer mostly behind the scenes and sometimes in front of the scenes. I am now a full-time host. That really didn't happen until, I'd say at this point, about 4 years ago.
Wow.
And they finally said, What do you think about being a full-time host? And that was based on, you know, years of kind of doing the dance of both. So it's not like I didn't have the experience. I just didn't have the opportunity to make the full-time switch. And then they gave me the opportunity.
Although I got to say, that's one of my all-time favorite, you know, like not gags, or it's not like a show trope, is the producer or the editor or the engineer that becomes a part of the production.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Every good property I've ever worked on, the person behind the camera is sort of, if not a vocal participant, is like a character. You know, my mm-hmm. wife helped us produce a movie review show that we ran for around 3 years. And even though producer Marie was only on camera, I think 3 times for the entire run of that show, she used to get her own fan mail from people yes. that just knew she was behind the camera. And you're like, it's totally. Amazing how that influence still manifests or it still contributes to the overall property.
Yeah, it's almost like the obscurity of that one voice that you hear so infrequently. I mean, podcasting, you know, it's such a personal, mm-hmm. like a personal experience. For you and I, and for creators, like we're talking into a microphone, we're trying our best to be, you know, as authentic as we can be in ourselves, in our opinions, you know, to represent our passions about a certain subject or whatever. For everyone else, like they're listening to our voices in their ears every single day as if we're standing right next to them. And it's amazing what they pick up on, what people pick up on. You know, I'll run into people who have been listening to my shows apparently for years, and they'll bring up some really random thing like, oh, whatever happened to, you know, the guy that jumped out of the barrel, blah, blah. I'm like, what are you even talking about? And meanwhile, for them, it's like this legendary story that they never got closure on. You know,
it's their inside joke with me that I didn't know we had.
Yes, exactly.
And they'll make a reference to something like, I don't know what you mean. And then I've been trying to be very careful. Like someone brought up something that I had written. Actually, it wasn't one of my videos. And like I was really racking my brain. I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah.
Can you help me out? And it was almost like this defeat. Like I just completely let the wind out of this inside joke sail. Oh. And he had to send me a link to one of my own.
I really thought you'd know.
Oh man.
Anyways.
And it just like I felt gutted on his behalf.
I know. I totally know that feeling. But so which is to say that I completely like I understand the experience that, you know, people who are listening to your show and, you know, maybe your wife has only really been on the show 2 or 3 times, but suddenly that becomes a real touch point. I mean, mm-hmm. I've experienced that in a number of shows. I always try and bring in the people who are producing the shows now, especially because that's just the example that was set in front of me. But when I, you know, when I first started on Buzz Out Loud and I was hardly talking at all, you know, suddenly that gave the audience, like I would start to get the same type of mail. It was like, you know, because no one ever saw my face, so they only ever heard my voice. And so for like a couple of years it was like, what does Jason look like? And then they see a picture and they're like, whoa, he looks way different than I ever thought he'd look. You know, it's just interesting to see these stories, this like mythology that builds up around you when you do this sort of work.
Well, it's one of the things that I mean not to kind of like blow smoke here, but it's one of the things that I very much enjoy about the Twit format for shows is how inclusive it feels. I mean I'm sure like every family of production team goes through some internal conflicts, and I'm not going to ask you to air any dirty laundry there, but it was one of the challenges at Newegg when Trisha and I were doing our weekly live streams, is we did not want it to seem like it was Trisha and I as these masters of video production and live streaming. And we fought really hard. It's like, we want the other Newegg ninjas to be featured on this show. When there's this awesome PC build, we probably didn't make it. And we have the people right here who can answer some of those technical questions. And we have these amazing resources. And I was actually kind of surprised by some of the internal pushback to that idea. Like, showing some of the seams around the production might make us seem less professional, where I kind of felt it actually put us in a better light. So again, it's one of the things, like, I love it when a producer chimes in the middle of your show, or there's like a, you know, breaking news, you know, like we've got to insert a little piece of information so that we can clarify a point. And to me, that's so much more responsible and so much more interactive for your audience than the opposite some might seem.
Yeah. It's kind of like the old TV paradigm is that
these are
the people that are on, and they are the experts, and they are the only ones that you want to listen to, and you will idolize them because they are inaccessible. And
we do television promos where in slow motion we cross our arms.
Hair goes whipping. But yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of what we do as creators online. Everybody's completely accessible. You just have to know kind of how to reach them. Is it a forum? Is it their social media account? And everybody that is involved with the production. I completely agree. I love listening to a podcast where the people who are producing are just as much involved in the being a character or having their voices heard as everyone else, as makes sense. I mean, it's just a different element, a different factor of the medium in which we participate now that really differentiates it from this supreme celebrity kind of model that has been around for generations with TV and film. Meanwhile, people who watch, their favorites on YouTube, listen or watch to their favorite people on podcasts, like they are just as interested and in sometimes gobsmacked when they meet their idols from those areas in person, or when, say, someone emails into All About Android and I actually email them back and say, hey, this isn't going to make it on the show, but here's my answer, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, oh my God, it's, and it's just funny. It's it's funny to me because I'm just a dude right now podcasting in my bedroom. I have a microphone.
I may or may not be wearing pants right now.
Yeah, I might be wearing pajamas. I'm looking out. My neighbors are out, across. We're all just human beings, but it's just, it's so cool and very humbling to do something that actually other people look forward to consuming or listening to or viewing. It's a total, it's a gift that we have as creators to be able to even do that. And even better, to get paid for it. It's kind of crazy that we can do this. It's a lot of fun.
It's this wholly unique situation. It's this wholly unique perspective. And I very much enjoy spending my time with those people that seem to kind of respect, the creators who haven't taken it for granted, because it just feels so precious to me that this is a part of what I get to, this is a part of what I get to contribute.
Totally.
To all of this. So, along those same lines, you'll pardon. I actually had notes here and I didn't write out some of my dossier from doing my background on you.
Sounds so official.
I know it's because I run a very professional show. Super. An army of one producing this podcast here. Please correct me here. You've been the head of All About Android for 5 years. Is that how long the show's been running now?
Well, let's see here. I started at Twit in September 2010. It was shortly, it was like January or February of 2011 when we had our first alpha episodes or beta episodes, whatever you want to call it, alpha and then beta episodes, which can still be found on YouTube, our very, very first ones. And it was me, Eileen Rivera, and Ron Richards. First couple of episodes were just me and Eileen. Eileen is actually Tom Merritt's wife. She worked at Twit for a number of the earlier years, and her and I had a fondness for Android, and we decided to start a show about Android because it didn't exist on the Twit network. And then a couple of episodes into our alphas, we brought Ron Richards in. Ron has been, on the show ever since as well.
Was that still back during some of those earlier Blip.TV and Revision 3 days? Because Ron is OG podcasting and web series too. So
yeah, I mean, I believe Rev 3 was still around there around that time. I bet, it ended. God, I don't know when it officially ended. And I can't remember if Ron was still on with Rev 3 at that point. I have to guess that he wasn't. My memory is failing me a little bit there. But yes, around that time period. And so the three of us did the show for, I think, 3 or 4 years until Eileen transitioned away from Twit. And then I guess you would say that I kind of like moved into kind of like the lead producer role, essentially. Ever since then, but we've been doing the show since 2011. Almost 10 years at this point.
So, I mean, what kind of festivities and gala are you going to front for your 10-year anniversary?
Probably not much, to be honest.
Offline, we're going to chat. We got to do something. It's going to be big. It's going to be huge.
Sure,
we're both on the West
Coast.
Something.
I'm sure we're going to do something. Usually, like, every 100 episodes, we don't, it's not that we'd have a celebration, but right. What I like to do every 100 episodes, because it's a nice round number, is I like to invite anyone who's been an official member of the cast back for that episode, mm-hmm. to just like, hey, what are you doing? You know, they tend to be a little less about Android, a little more about like, what are they up to now? You know, because every 100 episodes when you're doing a weekly is about every a little less than two years.
2 years, yeah.
And so, you know, lives change a lot in a couple of years. And it's always great to get, you know, like Eileen or Chad Johnson was one of the technical directors, or Brian Burnett, you know, all of those faces that have been on over the years back on, because like, you know, touching on what we were talking about earlier, even our TDs, our technical directors and our behind the scenes producers, like they become these characters and voices on the show that people just love. So when we bring them back, it's like they're celebrities returning to the show. It's like, hey, Chad's back again, you know, and everything that you loved about Chad, there he is again, you know? And so I don't know. I mean, and the reason that I say we probably won't make a huge deal of it, Leo Laporte, who runs twit.tv, he's done so many shows on the network at this point, and they all kind of hit these touch points inevitably at some point. Yeah. And I think his perspective, which I kind of agree with, is if we really celebrated this for every single show, we'd be celebrating like very, very frequently between one or the other shows, you know? And so I think over the years, it's kind of become less of a, oh my God, we made it. And now just like, oh, hey, we're there. Yay. High five.
So I mean, like, not to argue with Leo, as he can't defend himself in this conversation that we're having right now. Yeah. I kind of feel once a streaming show reaches a milestone like 10 years, you would be looking at like a class reunion,
yeah,
type high school situation. I kind of feel like that's worth at least like, I don't know, some little party poppers, maybe a cake.
We'll probably, yeah, you're right. We'll probably do something along those lines. To say that there will not be any sort of acknowledgement or celebration, we probably will. Who am I kidding? But it is interesting. You're right. The 10 year marker is a pretty interesting point, because now, like, I can go back to those episodes from almost 10 years ago and look at all of us, and we look like little babies compared to where we are
crazy,
now. You
isn't
know,
it?
Like 10 years is long enough for you to really see an evolution of a person's growth. You know, it's kind of crazy.
My first show we produced weekly, we started in 2009, and we just found a hard drive with a bunch of the finished episodes that we thought we'd lost.
Oh,
we're going back and watching them. It was me, my best friend, and my wife were the kind of core three that started it. And like, I barely recognize those people on camera. And I don't think I've changed that much, but I've obviously changed that much.
Yeah. Oh, I know, right. Because we look at ourselves every single flipping day in the mirror. It's hard to see those changes until you suddenly have like the before and after. You're like, whoa.
Oh.
I thought I was grown up then. I wasn't grown up. I'm grown up now, but not then. You know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, all right, for me, cool. I'm glad that you went to the grown-up side of it, because for me it was like, I still look young. Oh, I do not look young. Oh, that is not good. So I kind of have to ask for that forgiveness. I really thought, for some reason in my brain, I had locked in on like 5 or 6 years that All About Android had been kind of in its run. Over 10 years, almost 10 years
almost
now,
yeah. Yeah.
I'm sure your relationship with the audience has probably morphed and evolved over that period of time. What would you say are some of the bigger changes in how you interact with this community or interact with these other enthusiasts from maybe where we were a couple years back versus 10 years back?
That's an interesting question to answer. Let me think about this one. I mean, when we first started the show, Twitter was, you know, Twitter was a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I definitely was on Twitter from a very early point. I think what's changed for me is that I'm far more selective on how I interact with community now than I did then. And that's either a good or a bad thing, I think, depending on your perspective. Then I spent a lot of time engaging. And, you know, via Twitter, any emails, like I set a requirement for myself, like any of the emails that we get to our email address for the show, whether it makes it into the show or not, I'm going to reply to every single one. I want everyone to know that we're listening, that we're reading, that we welcome, and I still want them to know this. But at a certain point, things just got really difficult to keep up that speed and to keep up that momentum and that attention. Engaging on all the social platforms, replying to all the emails. Like if I wanted to just get my job done and actually produce a show, it became more and more difficult to do that because of all these other requirements that I was placing on myself. And it was a hard decision for me, I think, over a period of time where I had to like find acceptance in myself for the fact that I can't be the nice host that replies to every single person all the time anymore. Like I just can't. I can't do that and still do the things that, you know, that people who are following the shows actually want. And, you know, I felt like that kind of made me not a bad person, but a less kind of open, kind of connected person. And then, you know, I would say in very recent years, I've detached even further from social media, less because of that and more just because like the news started to really, you know, make me think differently about my involvement with social media. You know, I would put all of me and my life out on social media for years. And then at a certain point, it was like, well, wait a minute, maybe that's not the smartest thing for me to do. And certainly if, you know, with my kids, why is it okay for me to decide for them that their likeness, their face, their stories, their lives should be public consumption? Like, it's not up for me to decide that. I may be their parents, but I don't want them to grow older and then look back and be like, holy crap, Dad really told them everything. You know? Like, I want them to feel like they have their own life that's separate from like my need to like, you know, share everything about my life and, you know, all the data privacy stuff and everything. So my opinion on social media changed. And I think the downside to that is that in recent years, I've become maybe a little less engaged with the community in the way that I was, because I just kind of stepped away from those social media conversations a little bit more. I will say that I found more of a balance now, and I found my way back to it. And really, for me, it's striking a balance between, you know, engaging in ways that relate to the show, and in some ways that can be like, here's a slice of my life, because people love to know, you know, what everybody's up to outside of the show. Like, that's really, really great and everything. Without like sharing everything, without like giving all information and showing every little thing that my children, my two daughters do, which I would love to share, but you know, I just kind of like I have reservations about it. So it's really finding a balance.
I know my wife and I had some really brutal conversations before Lex was born. It kind of hinged to both of us having kind of an overly developed sense of fair play. We're both the oldest siblings in our families. And for us, like we grew up without every waking moment of our lives being broadcast publicly for internet points. And
indeed,
it kind of seemed fair to give Lex a chance.
Right. An opportunity to have some sort of an opinion about that. And who knows? I mean, the way my kids are right now, especially my older daughter, like she would love to have her own YouTube channel. And she's just asking me this morning. She's like, Dad, can I have a YouTube channel? You don't ever have to show my face. You can just show my hand playing with slime and then I'll make lots of money. And I'm like, okay.
Wow.
We got to talk about this, because, you know, the money just doesn't happen with YouTube. There's a whole, you know, So there's a part of me that looks at her desire to be involved in an internet social sort of way And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe she'd grow older and she wouldn't care. But I want to give her the opportunity.
I kind of feel no, but I'm with you on that point. And I'll be curious to see how wrong I am. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I'm sure I'm doing something wrong, but in with the best of intentions, I'll be curious to see how off I am, because I kind of look at guys our age as being the Rosetta Stone generation. You know, we grew up at a time where we probably still had corded tele. I had a rotary phone, was the first family phone in our household. And I will be one of those rarities that can kind of speak before internet and post internet in a sort of a reasonably tech savvy way. When my daughter gets older, like, my daughter's 4 and she's already hosting shows on the cameras on our phones, right?
Yep.
There's already like an osmosis of what daddy does and what mommy works
say,
on.
You're her idol in that regard.
Yeah. So she actually shot a video for Nani, you know, my mom, walking around the house, giving her a tour of the house. She's 4 and she's already using more advanced video.
Yeah, right. She's already doing, yes, what used to be like really difficult for anyone to do. Yeah.
And like, her framing is terrible, but it's getting better, right? Like, her ability
start
to
somewhere
to hold a phone or hold a tablet and talk to it. But when she gets a little bit older, I kind of feel the trends for the up and coming generation of people do not resemble what our fascination was at peak social media. And so I'm sure she's going to get a little older and we're going to have, you know, some butting of the heads between like what she should be allowed to do or, you know, how to best protect herself, you know, learning those skills in an ever evolving climate. But I also kind of feel like I think she'll appreciate some of what we tried to do, even if all of it wasn't very successful, just for us being a little bit ahead of the tech curve on things like a bit of healthy skepticism about social media and what kind of impact it can have on our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll be curious to see that too. I guess with my daughter, so she's 10, and then our other daughter in a few days turns 7. So they're, I guess they're at an age, especially my 10-year-old, she's at an age where we're looking at, you know, what she's going to be interested in from a social media perspective, if mm-hmm. social media, you know, follows the same kind of paradigm that it's in right
that
now.
It's on right now.
Not too long from now. What is that? 4 or 5? I don't know how many years it is before suddenly she's really, really interested in that. Maybe sooner. I wonder how it's going to shift and change, or, you know, if those perspectives do shift and change at all. Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I do know that I'm a little hesitant for when that happens, but I think I'll be equipped as a father and a technology minded father to
both my wife and I
steer them
out of
the right direction.
Entertainment and talent. You know, we worked for talent agencies and then we worked for casting agencies. And when you've seen like some of the families that kind of come up with child actors, and you can see mm-hmm. the families that really work together and protect their little community and try and keep everyone grounded. And then you see some of the families that don't operate so well under that kind of, in that kind of system, you know, I can only hope that like Lex will at least appreciate the attempt we made more than just
totally.
Like, you were an adorable little kid and we could have blown you up and made you famous.
Right. Throw you to the wolves. Yeah, exactly. No, that's I feel the same way. Same way.
Hey, folks, are you getting bored of the current collection of tech and geek commentary on the internet? Is the discussion of new electronics feeling a bit stale? Do you want to find some fresh voices to add to your subscription queue? Check out the community on rglowingrectangles on Reddit. Now, this subreddit was built to help new voices in the tech community find more audience, and we need your support. Sharing, commenting, and those precious, tasty upvotes. Reddit can radically help a content creator expand their reach. Do you know a producer who deserves more attention? Do you just want to find fun new stuff? Head on over to reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles and share or browse to your heart's content. Once again, reddit.com/r/glowingrectangles, and let's build something cool together.
So I'm just to circle back to, you know, some of the what you were talking about, your own sort of roller coaster ride with social media. You were trying to kind of back off for very professional reasons, because I don't think it's easy for us to ever explain, like how much work and how much time the social media side of this can kind of take out of our production day. But then that also seemed to naturally dovetail with the general consumer conversation that we've been having about sort of the uglier side of social media. Mm-hmm. How has that, if you could just sort of expand on that a little bit more, how has that impacted some of the relationships? I'm sure you've had longtime viewers that maybe mm-hmm. were accustomed to getting in touch with you in one way, and maybe that's a platform you were starting to kind of chill out with. It's an opportunity to invest in other relationships or in other kinds of conversations in other places. What did that look like for you as you were trying to stay focused on getting your core show done?
I mean, I felt like in some ways it feels a little bit like out of sight, out of mind. Like in stepping away and realizing that I was stepping away to focus a little bit more on the shows and on the content and everything like that, it became a little easier for me to not know what kind of connection I may have been breaking in the process, if there was one. I probably hold myself accountable more so than actually happened, because it's not like I completely stopped, you know, like dropped off the face.
I don't think any of us really could have.
No, and I don't think that we can, right? Like, I think that's the bigger challenge for me is the question between doing this because it feels like the right thing to do, or not doing it because our job almost requires us to do it, or, you know, mm-hmm. Our jobs kind of require us to be have a social media presence to a certain degree. And so then I feel a little guilty, like stepping away from it a little bit, because I feel like maybe I'm not doing my job the way I should be. You know, I'm not actually right. doing my job. So I don't know. I feel like maybe I hold myself a little more accountable than others do. I still have a great connection with, you know, a lot of people on Twitter. I see a lot of the same names and faces flash across and comments and ads to things that I'm putting out there. So I still feel connected. It was just, man, before I was like throwing all of me out there, and at a certain point it felt like that was just a little too much. So I don't know. I mean, I ask myself that question, mm-hmm. when I actually have days where I'm not involved in like this back and forth conversation and I'm more focused on creating content, like, have I severed ties or have I upset people who are used to having that kind of open
right.
conversation? And I mean, I have to trust that the people on the other side of the screen understand that sometimes it's just not possible. Sometimes it's just not easy. We're all human. We're all doing the best that we can.
For sure.
And so that's me too. And
it's also a little bit of that trust exercise. I guess I should also say it's the audience I want is the audience who's understanding. And if someone's not going to be understanding of that, then I kind of care less if they're trying to participate or get my attention.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, totally.
I mean, to put it in kind of a snarky way.
Yeah. No, but you're right. Like, there's a whole wide spectrum of people out there. And there are definitely a lot of people out there that are far more forgiving, far more understanding. And then there are a lot of people out there, unfortunately, who really don't have any insight into the challenges outside of their own lives, mm-hmm. let's say. Maybe that's putting it nicely. And so, yeah, I mean, they're all different types of human beings, and doing what we do, we come across everyone's path.
For sure.
And so inevitably we're going to cross paths with people who don't understand that we all, you know, have these challenges that we face, and maybe that's the reason we are or are not doing it. That ties into my own perspectives that I still have a hard time with around right. like internet trolling and that sort yeah. of stuff. When I am approached online by an internet troll, like, there's like this nice guy part of me that I've had as a part of me, a very, you know, big component of my life from a very young age, that never wants to just cut ties, never yeah. wants to cut a relationship, even if it's a troll. Like, sometimes I have a really hard time saying block because I'm like, no, that, but I'm a jerk if I block someone. I can't do that. I'm not a jerk. And it's like, yeah, but at the same time, like, what is the respect that this person is showing me?
For sure.
Is that healthy for my for my mind and for my existence in this moment? You know,
when I started it is something doing that I struggle stuff like with. I mean, I'm so glad that you phrased it that way. When I kind of realized it was about 2 years ago. It was a little while after I'd stepped down from Pocket Now, and I had this moment where I'm writing out these replies on YouTube, and I'm coming to the understanding like I'm just getting mean, like. I'm fighting with people. Oh. And
Right.
And it was the idea of muting, not even like blocking people, just like, you know, a tool on Twitter or a tool on YouTube where you can just mute someone. They don't even know that you've quieted their conversation. Just felt like such a fundamental betrayal of what it was that I started out trying to do in this space. The idea of silencing a voice, even someone heckling me. Just felt like it was gutting. But then at the same time, I'm sitting here and it's like 3 a.m. and I am like in a manic state pounding out these replies on this, you know, really clacky gaming keyboard. And you're like, well, that's also not healthy.
Right. Right. No, totally. It's not. The whole YouTube comment thing. Because yes, that indeed definitely happens. You get those comments, and you know, like I've definitely experienced that, where it's like my initial response is, okay, I'm gonna get defensive now because this person's calling me out on something they shouldn't be calling me out on, or they're being rude, and I've got the greatest comeback, blah blah blah. And I think that one of the things that I've learned over the years that works really well for me is to always reply with, how do I put it, like, I never reply. I really try my best. Every once in a while, I can't help it, and I will reply the little snarky reply, and then I immediately regret it. You know what I mean? I'm like, why did I do that?
I do that all the time.
I could have taken the high road.
I still choose the low road more often than I should. And you're right. I immediately regret it, but like, there's that little sick thrill of satisfaction, and then I'm like, all right, this is not good for me. I've got to walk away. One of the things I've always been kind of curious about, if you don't mind me just kind of tangenting off that idea for a second, the fact that Twit formats individual shows for individual topics, does that give you guys like a little bit more of a segmented audience where there's less of that, like, my team's better than your team, you know, kind of one-upsmanship? Like, there's very rarely do you have like Apple versus Android. You know, it's not a core makeup of the DNA of your commentary. It's Android has this community and we really want to do the best possible conversation we can for them. Apple has this community and we really want to focus on them. Does that give you guys a little bit of a demilitarized zone between some of those really nasty trolls?
Yeah, I will say I'm proud to hear you say that, because I know that that's a core belief that I feel. I really try my very best to not get involved in the kind of like cross operating system wars, you know, this is better than that, blah, blah, blah. We play it up sometimes on All About Android, but we do it in a joking way, I think, for the most part.
It's really lighthearted. You know? Like,
we really have no sense of seriousness when we do it. And I think what you're picking up on probably is explained by the fact that, like, people who watch and listen to Twit podcasts and the people who are on the shows, like, we all just love technology. Mm-hmm. Like, our interests, our Venn diagram is one giant overlap of technology. We just enjoy technology. And, you know, whether you're on an iPhone and I'm on an Android phone, like, there's, I don't know, it's easy for me to understand why there is great in all of these things. Mm-hmm. It might not be what I choose, it might not be what I use, but I totally recognize when Apple has a really great idea in their phone. I'm like, God, I just wish Android had that. Like, why doesn't it have it?
Anytime they want to give us iMessage, I will happily install it on any Android device I'm using.
Juan, don't worry. Google will give you another iMessage. They do it every year. You'll have plenty more opportunities for iMessage.
I don't want another. I still use Hangouts. No.
But I don't know. I think that's possibly an explanation of it. We don't. I don't feel like we incite our audience to go down that road either. We certainly aren't, you know, waving a flag that says, yeah, all Android is awesome and you others suck. Hey, what do you think, everybody? Pile on in social media. You know, we try not to go down that
a bunch of sycophants.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
It's one of those.
I think we kind of roll our eyes actually when we see that happening. Well, it's because like, well, let's do something a little more balanced.
Isn't that, and again, not like I'm trying to out another producer. I mean, it's so hard to make content online and to cultivate an audience. And anyone who's got that hustle, I think, ultimately deserves some respect. But it's been one of the concerning elements that I found over, as I would say, over the last 5 years, where post YouTube adpocalypse, that sort of a, you know, drawing the line in the sand, courting YouTube analytics and metrics above kind of an internally consistent philosophy of reviewing has become really problematic for someone like me who, above all else, I know I'm labeled as like the BlackBerry Sony LG shill, but I genuinely thirst for the best possible competition. And we can't have that if we keep whittling down the number of competitors to like one or two in any given segment. When you guys are crafting editorial and you're looking at what products to cover, it's been so refreshing as an audience member, because every week on your show, I know I'm going to get some Samsung news, and I know I'm going to get some Google news, and then I know I'm still going to hear about, you know, like Anubia. I know I'm still going to hear about OnePlus and Huawei and all these other brands that actually make up what I enjoy about Android, is that it should be this vibrant.
Sure.
How conscious is that cultivation? I mean, like, do you guys, how, I mean, not to like give up all of your secrets on how you produce your show, because then I'll just rip off your show.
No secrets.
but I mean, it seems like it has to be by design that you guys aren't just saying, this is exactly what's going to give us the best possible SEO week over week over week. So let's just talk Samsung all day, every day.
Yeah, I definitely don't think that when it comes to producing the content for the show, I'm ever really looking at it from a, let's only do the things that are going to drive SEO. I personally, my kind of podcast mantra, if you will, not that it's an official mantra, I'm making it up right now, but my podcast ethos is entirely do a show on the thing you love. And if you love all of these things, rope those in there. It doesn't have to be driven by SEO, because your passion is what brings people that connection, right? So even if I was doing a show about a brand nobody loved, if we were passionate about it and we did a good job of connecting with each other about it, then the people who also like that are going to connect with that content. They're going to be like, that's the best damn, I'm trying to think of like a super obscure Android brand to call out.
Unihertz.
I don't need to.
There you go.
Yes.
That's
the best damn Unihertz podcast I've ever listened to. You know, so when it comes, and actually, as far as All About Android is concerned, the design of the show makes it really easy to kind of spread the love, because we've got three main segments: news, hardware, apps, and within those segments, we've got three blocks, three story blocks. And so it's really just a matter of pulling up all the major news from the week. And, you know, I just open all of the stories that jump out to me when I'm browsing my many different feeds or whatever. And I end up with a row of tabs, and then I go through them and I throw them in the dock, and I end up with more than three in each category. And then at some point I'm like, all right, well, this has to go down to three. So what are the survivors?
Right.
You know, and if I've got a ton of Samsung in the top block, then yeah, I want to spread the love. I want Xiaomi to get in there. I want Huawei. Right. And we actually get at times we get a decent amount of feedback from people that are like, why are you covering these phones? You'll never get these phones in the US. It doesn't matter. Yes, we are a US company. Yes, we are very US centric when it comes to a lot of the content on the show, but I don't want that to be our only view of the Android space, because the Android space is worldwide. It's so varied. It's not just phones. It's everything. And so it all deserves some time. And really, at the end of the day, it's like, well, what's the best story out of the collection of stories that I put in here? And that's how it gets chosen.
And then also for me, it becomes an anchor point. You know, there are so many times where like I run a little subreddit for my show, and people just promote other content creators that they feel deserve more attention. And I've been getting more EU, UK, and Indian. And the perspectives are so wild. And then I'll finish a video and say, I desperately wish we had that kind of competition here. They're working in product segments that we just don't get here in the United States. And I think if more people understood that, they'd probably be a little frustrated that we don't get in the United States, this bastion of high-tech consumerism. And you're like, but phones from $400 to $700, we get like three.
Yeah, yeah. And not always the best three, or not always the most intriguing three. It's just the three that had the deals from somehow or whatever, you know, that the carriers were open to. Yeah.
So, Jason, if you don't mind, because I know we're kind of getting in, getting a little past an hour here, and I do want to start kind of bring this home, but I'd like to spend a little time. The fact that you are an extremely accomplished musician that I have been listening through some of the content that you've been posting up on your blog, and because you had that background in audio, I came out of spoken word. So, you know, voice actors and you know, poets and audiobooks and things like that. And they all secretly wish that they were musicians, right? You know, like, I've met so many animation actors that roll into session looking like they came out of an 80s hair metal video because they desperately want to be rock stars. I mean, I'm not joking. Like, there are a few. I'm not going to name names again, but like,
that's awesome.
That's hilarious.
Love it.
So this is your what do you call this for yourself? Is it the side gig? Is this your passion project? And what would you say your musical influences have been? Because I've been very taken with some of the behind the scenes, you know, how you arranged a piece, blog posts on your site.
Oh, cool. Oh, right on. So the music that I create is under the name Yellow Gold, one word. And Yellow Gold was just a name that I chose with a friend of mine when we were creating music back in high school. We each had our own little four-track recorders, and it's like we created challenges against each other. My band name is Yellow Gold. Yeah, well, mine is the Fabulous Medicine Men, which was actually his band name, and I love that name. But we would create like we would do like a whole mythology around it, and be like, well, I'm coming out with a single next week, and it's going to have these four songs, and we do artwork, blah blah blah, and then we just trade the music, whatever. So Yellow Gold has been a thing that I write music since, you know, high school. So 25-ish, if not more years at this point. Definitely, it's a passion. Like, it's a thing that I do for me. It's always been a thing that I do for me. I'm a musical person. I've always got music ideas in my head. It's a matter of, like, capturing those ideas in whatever way I can. And I've just found a process that works so that I can, you know, have an idea, speak it into Evernote and a number of different audio recordings that represent different instruments. And then when it's time to like sit down in the studio, I take those and I basically turn them into instruments. You know, I use the instruments that I'm talking about and singing about and make the song out of it. And I create an album and put it out. Having said that, so it's a passion of mine to create music. It's not something that I'm doing all the time, though. Like, I'm, you know, at the last album, Fever Dreamer, I spent, 2.5 years creating it. And this was like in the evenings after everything was done, go in there into my studio area for a couple hours and just, you know, refine. By the time it was done, like, I was so ready to not play music for a while because it had been so long and I'd heard those songs so many times. So it's like a passion project, and I finally get to releasing the album and getting it out there and everything. And then I'm just like, I'm done until the next time that I find my, you know, my music itch needing to be scratched again. And it's been a couple of years since I've done it. So it's like I ebb and I flow in and out, and I feel myself kind of being pulled back in, but it's, you know, it's hard because you get so busy. To answer your question, as far as like influences and stuff, I don't know. I mean, I guess my music is really indie rock, a little bit of kind of like, I don't know if you're familiar with the shoegaze category of music, My Bloody Valentine, Slow Dive.
This is all
like 90s kind of ethereal alternative rock influences. I also used to be a DJ, like a house DJ. So, you know, there's electronic music influences that I put in there. It's really just like, I have an idea. What can I do to this song to make it sound cool to me? Like if I'm like sitting there listening to it and go, I think that sounds cool, then I feel like my job is done. And if anyone else likes it,
cool,
great. But I'm really not doing it for anyone else. I'm doing it entirely for myself. I just so happen to then release an album because it's also fun to do that. And but influence is all over the map. It's whatever I'm listening to at the time. Really covers.
But again, I just always love that in like the true sort of creator space. It's not just like, oh, I kind of fiddle around with some music and it's fine. No, it's like there's that, it's like that last step of actually making the effort to put it out there. I mean, like it's consumable and it's a part of the story. Again, you know, we've been talking about technology and stuff, but these tools that help us enable our ability to kind of reach out, communicate, produce, and kind of fulfill those artistic endeavors. It's exciting to me because that helps contribute to us to a conversation about technology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is a part of that. You know, these are the tools, and really the only thing that's stopping you is literally the time and the effort to invest in producing something that's in your brain, and you literally can, and this is how, and this is why.
Which is a really cool place to be right now, because when I was in university for audio production and mm-hmm. had the dream of going into a recording studio, yes, audio plugins existed.
Mm-hmm.
But the audio industry, the music production industry, wasn't driven on plugins the way it is now.
No.
Literally, like, then if you wanted to have an amazing studio with amazing quality, you know, the ability to do all these things that you hear in songs on radio and all these other places, you had to have money. Like, you had to have a lot of money to outfit your studio with a lot of hardware gear. And there was a barrier to entry. Like, if you had the space and you had the money to do that, that barrier to entry is really low now. And that's not just for music production. That's for video production. I mean, all across the board, when you're talking about digital creatives, it has been democratized to such an insane level. I wish that I could take the now paradigm and zip it back to when I was in high school creating music with my friend on a 4-track video, cassette tape recorder. Yeah. At the same time, I'm also happy that I can't do that, because that required me and my friend to get really creative.
Yeah.
Because we were locked into 4 tracks and we had to figure out how we make these songs with multiple parts and everything fit into 4, you know, simultaneous tracks, and that involved bouncing between tracks and whatever. It you had to get really creative. Now it's like it's unlimited. So now we've got the opposite problem. Now it's like you can do anything and everything you ever want to. So find your point of focus and make that happen. And it's like you get distracted by all the leaves in a tree. You just can't focus on one leaf, you know?
Totally.
So it becomes the opposite problem. You've got too many choices.
I mean, like, I'm glad you phrased it that way. I would never trade. I did like a brief stint at a radio station in New Mexico, and the guy I was working with taught me so much about mic technique that moved with me into commercial voiceover and voice acting. But he made this big play. We were just at the cusp of like DAT and hard disk recording, and we were moving from like tape to digital decks and stuff. And he made me, you know, retime a drum track by cutting tape. And you're like, yeah, I know you kids all have all this fancy stuff, but tape's never going away. There's too much of an infrastructure in tape. You at least have to learn. You at least have to know how to do this. And I'm glad I had that experience.
Which is true. It's nice to know that. It is good to know that.
I've never touched tape since. And so like there's also that part of me, like, you know, I have so much technique, and if my daughter decides she wants to get in production, there's so much that I can teach her, and I will be so happy. I'll never make her, you know, pull out some tape and the razor blades and the wood block, and she'll never have to do that.
Yes, it is a total pain to have to splice tape like that. No doubt. But at the same time, like you're saying, like I'm happy that I got the experience to do that. Would I know how to do that now? I could probably figure it out. I'd probably mess it up horribly.
Real bad.
But I'm happy that I got that, at least. It's perspective.
To kind of wrap up, I've got two sort of my gimmicky end of podcast questions. The first one is always serious. We've been talking about, you know, passion projects and online content creation and kind of what it's like to be a storyteller in this bizarre modern age that we find ourselves in. Obviously, a lot of people like to dabble with this stuff and not to be cynical, but there are times where you can kind of get the sense if someone's serious or not about pursuing this with some energy. That rare individual comes up to you who you feel is like legit. Like they're really reaching out and they've got a good head on their shoulders. What's one of the main pieces of advice that you would give that person who's looking at starting this type of an online or content creation career?
I think my answer would probably be something that I actually have already spoken on the show, because I think it's critical, and that's to follow whatever your passion is, mm-hmm. right? Getting into content creation, on a topic that is SEO friendly, top of mind, everybody's talking about this. Oh, that's the new thing. Cool. I'm going to do a podcast about that. I just personally, I mean, I'm not saying that it can't happen. I'm not saying that you can't totally, you know, find your audience and rock it like crazy by choosing a topic or a direction in that way. But I guarantee you, if you're passionate about something, your chances are much greater that you're going to connect with your audience, because ultimately people are really smart. Listeners and viewers are smart. Whether they realize they're smart in this way or not, that's a different story. But they understand on an innate level authenticity yeah. of the person on the other side of the camera or the other side of the microphone. And if that person is passionate about what they're talking about, there's an authentic sense that I think is portrayed that travels between the host into the viewer's own passion about it or the listener's passion about it too. And I just think that's really critical. I think that's super important given what we do, you know, mm-hmm. in this space. Maybe it's a little different if you're talking about TV and film. I'm sure there are different things needed there. But as far as, you know, podcast and YouTube and that sort of stuff, I think passion is pretty, pretty essential.
Okay. And now for the silly question. And that was a great answer, by the way. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
Didn't mean to just kind of, you know, jump. Okay, cool. No, yeah, that's what it is.
It's all good.
The silly question now. Jason.
Yes.
A terrible tragedy has befallen mankind. This is like the end of days kind of a situation here. Thankfully, you and all of your family members and all of your loved ones are safe. But okay. In this catastrophe, you were only able to grab 3 Android devices to stock as the museum pieces to represent mobile technology. Three Android boy. Devices will populate your humanity museum? Go.
Oh geez, I'm gonna upset someone here, I know, because I'm gonna leave out some really obvious one. I think the Nexus 5 has to be there.
Okay.
That is hands down one of my favorite all-time devices. It was such a workhorse, mm-hmm. and it did well. There were a lot of things to hate about it, but it lasted for so long and people who had it loved it. So the Nexus 5, I got to put the Motorola Droid in there, because okay. it was my first Android device, and definitely it was one of the initial kind of one of the big early Android devices that really caught on, mm-hmm. that marketing slogan really worked. It's the third one that's really hard, man. That is the oh boy, it has to be a piece to hold on to for
I mean,
legacy.
This is it. This is your Sophie's choice. I mean, you've got years and years of Android development, and now you've got it comes down to the number 3 pick. The last one.
No, I don't even. Oh, geez, I don't even know where to go on this one, because at that point it gets a lot harder. I mean, the Sooner is pretty interesting. Do you remember the Sooner news of the past couple of months? So basically, like not too long ago, somebody went on eBay and sold a lot of the Sooner. The Sooner really? Was the earliest version, prototype version of Android. It didn't even have a touchscreen. It was basically looked like a BlackBerry. Yeah. And so when you're talking about like the earliest earliest iteration of Android, it's on that device. So I'm going to go for a cop-out. I'm going to say that one because when you're talking about museum, like, history, there you got to go with the very, very first thing, right? And if so, then I'm going to go with that. Like I'm a big fan of the Pixel. I use the Pixel. Mm-hmm. I love it and everything like that. But I don't know why I have hesitation picking it as my third. I don't know why that is, but I do. So I'm going to go with the Sooner.
Well, I think that's a perfectly acceptable answer that you will get numerous angry comments on.
I will, undoubtedly. Yep. I mean, you know, I will definitely be screamed at by a few people. But hey, at me with what you would pick. There you go.
We'll open this up. We'll open the conversation up for the show notes on this podcast. If anyone else would like to contribute there. Three museum piece phones. I'm sure they won't be better than Jason's.
There you they go. Might be. So, I might read them and be like, oh yeah, you're totally right. Yeah, I don't know why I didn't say that either.
I mean, the beautiful thing is like you haven't tried to turn it around on me, so I don't have an answer, and I'm not going to give you one. So,
all right, I'll let you off the hook. But the next time you're on All About Android, then you're going to have to answer that question.
With a ridiculous question. I welcome. The double dare challenge of your rejoinder in this ridiculous question.
All right, we'll do it.
So, Jason, I think that's probably the best place to kind of cap all of this. I want to thank you for jumping in and joining me on this this podcast conversation. Just for folks out there in the audience, what are you going to be working on next? Where can people catch what you produce? And also throw in a plug for your own personal music site there too, if you don't mind.
Oh, sure. Thank you so much. This is a lot of fun. I really enjoy doing shows with you, and I'm really honored that you invited me on to your show here. Of course, you're going to be back on All About Android sometime in the coming months.
I mean, you missed me for the LG episode. I mean, the LG shill didn't make it to the V60 conversation. I'm going to have to hold the phone in reserve.
Doesn't LG have like the Pearl coming out soon now?
Or the Velvet. So, the Velvet.
The Velvet. Not the Pearl. The Velvet. So we'll get you on for the Velvet. let's see here. So, okay, twit.tv is the main place to go. This Week in Tech, Leo Laporte's technology network. So twit.tv, I do All About Android there. Hands on Android is a new show. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's more of like a hands-on show on different topics, like turning your tablet into a second display for your computer or deep diving into the developer options in Android phone, that sort of stuff. So that's twit.tv/HOA. I also do an interview show on technology topics all across the board, not just Android, with Micah Sargent. That's called Tech News Weekly and a number of other shows. But just go to twit.tv and you'll see my face on a number of different places. And that's definitely where you want to check for that. I'm on Twitter at Jason Howell. And if you want to catch my music, you can find my music at Yellow Gold Music, yellowgoldmusic.com. I think if you go to jasonhowell.net, it'll redirect you there too, but guaranteed to get there, yellowgoldmusic.com. And I've got like three different albums there that you can get for free, or you can drop a few bones if you prefer. It's really up to you.
And people should drop a few bucks to pay what you want model. It's good stuff.
I don't care.
I've listened to it. I'll put it out there and I'll do your promo for you.
Thanks, man.
Follow your passions and find those people who share your passions. It's an easy bit of advice to deliver, but it means a lot more coming from someone who's been living it. A big thank you to Jason for joining me on this podcast, and I'm very much looking forward to when I can guest again on All About Android. Nudge, nudge. And a huge thank you to all of you listening right now, subscribing and sharing this podcast. If you'd like to help support the production of more conversations like these, please head on over to somegadgetguy.com where you'll find a support banner. That's where I keep all of my current partnerships and affiliates, including my Patreon, where patrons get ad-free versions of every show. And reviewing the show on your favorite podcasting service is always greatly appreciated. You know where you can find me around the rest of the internet, at SomeGadgetGuy on the Twitters and the Twitch, and the Facebooks and the Instagrams. And I will catch you all on the next podcast. Be well. Recording voiceover, spoken word, is truly one of my favorite activities. My second favorite hobby is photography. Now, the smartphone might be making us deaf, but we can't deny the awesome power of the phone as a platform for photography and multimedia creation. If you've been looking to improve your mobile photog skills, if you want to produce more professional content, or you're just looking to take your family photos to the next level, I wrote a book to help you out with that. Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs is available on Amazon Kindle. Walking through the basic terminology of photography, covering the settings on your camera, discussing composition and inspiration, and I even include a long list of exercises and challenges to really hone your skills, all with some helpful example photos and diagrams. Search for Take Better Photos, Smartphone Photography for Noobs on Amazon, or use the quick link bit.ly/betterphotosbook to grab your copy today.